Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Possessed of an unnatural and legendary hunger, the Reapers have come to Earth to establish a new order built on the harvesting of enslaved human souls. They rule the planet. They thrive on the scent of fear. And if it is night, as sure as darkness, they will come.
Graphic Audio presents E.E. Knights, Vampire Earth. Narrated by Ken Jackson. Performed by Tim Getman, Lily Beacon, Rick Rowan, Christopher Graybill, Scott McCormick, Joseph Thornhill, Kate Foster, Elizabeth Demery, Drew Copus, Daniel Gavigan, Mort Shelby, Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, Karen Novak, Thomas Penny, Tom Simpson, Tim Carlin, Dylan Lynch, Nanette Savard, Sonny Lasky, Britt Herring, Nick DePinto, Sherry Simpson, Casey Platt, Thomas Keegan, Ren Casey, Yasmin Toison, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Johan Detweiler, Barbara Pinolini, Ted Stoddard. Vampire Earth, Book 5, Valentine's Exile. Dallas, March, the 50th year of the Kurian Order. 4 square miles of concrete and structural steel smoke and pop and sputter as the city dies from the stranglehold of a siege. Viewed from above or on a headquarters map in one of the command bunkers, Big D is now a network of opposing circles. The largest circle encompasses the great towers of the city center, linked above the 20th floor by spiderweb-like cables that allow the sure-tentacled Kurians inter-building access without mixing with their human herds at street level. They show new holes and pits and hollows from the besiegers' guns and rockets. Mounds of debris and rubble stand in concentric rings, defended by batteries of guns manned by everyone from professional soldiers to minor functionaries in what until last year had been the affluent and sprawling North Texas Cooperative. Surrounding that central axis are an assortment of smaller circles, ringing the central battlements like the chambers in a revolver's cylinder. The closest to the front lines are Texas regulars out of the Pine Woods and the Rio Grande Belt. Others to the north and east fly the tricolors of the Ozarks. And a few smaller ones filling gaps to the rear are clusters of militias made up of men and women freed from the heavy hand of the cooperative. Northwest of the city rests one of these smaller circles, surrounding an airstrip once called Love Field. The soldiers there are not placed to assault the city. The ad hoc unit occupying the airport grew out of the rising in Little Rock that opened Operation Archangel. They participate in the siege both as a sentimental gesture of gratitude to the Texans who plunged down the Arkansas River to rescue them, and as being part of the gun-bristling ring that prevents an organized breakout. Their airfield joins the extreme left of the Ozark troops and the extreme right of the Texans. Their regimental flag, a black and blue silhouette of an Arkansas Razorback set under the joined Texas and Ozark flags, reads, "Don't feed on me." Judged from a distance, the forces in this particular encampment, called Valentine's Razors by the veterans, aren't in shape to serve as anything but a supporting unit. Only a few mortars and machine gun pits fill their lines, more for the defense of the camp than for battering those within the city. Instead, rolls of concertina wire on the open ground near the airstrip enclose cattle awaiting slaughter for the daily ration, and the airport's garages hum with the sounds of generators and power tools. On the march southwest from the Ozarks, the Razors proved invaluable in getting captured Kurian vehicles operational again, and in turning cattle, wheat, pigs, and corn into grist for various regimental kitchens. Their aptitudes reflect the rear area nature of many of the soldiers in the Razors, united by chance during the uprising in Little Rock. To a general of either side, looking at a map and possessed of a modicum of intelligence, military and personal, the Razors are one of the least threatening circles surrounding Big D. But quality can rarely be judged from a distance. The first clue is in the rifles that each on-duty soldier always has within reach. Long, heavy-barreled fillers with oversized banana magazines and integral bipods, some with telescopic sights, others with fixtures for high-capacity drum magazines. Souvenirs of the Razor's brief integration into Solon's army of the Trans-Mississippi, they are the best battle rifles the famous Atlanta Gunworks produces. Thanks to the Type 3s, any soldier is capable of turning into a supporting fire unit in a moment, given a simple wrench and a belt of the proper ammunition. Then there are the Prowlers. The mechanics of the Razors see to it that the best bits and pieces of Quisling wreckage make their way into the regimental motor pool, where they're assembled into armored cars and mortar transports. The Razors shouldn't have worked. Soldiers thrown together under the most dire of circumstances couldn't be expected to stand up to a determined assault, let alone hold a precarious position alone in the heart of enemy country. The success of their famous stand on the banks of the Arkansas River might be considered a measure as much of their enemy's incompetence as their own mettle. But some credit must be given to the improvisational skills of the officers who organized the Little Rock Rising. One of those men crosses the outskirts of the airstrip as the sun rises. His mottled dark green and gray uniform is thick with Dallas dust, an oatmeal-covered mixture of pulverized concrete, ash, and mundane winter dirt. Black hair tied in a pigtail hangs from his scalp, and a thin white scar on the right side of his face only serves to show off an early spring tan, bronzing indicative of an ample melanin in his jeans. A shortened version of his Razor's battle rifle with folding stock and cut-down barrel bumps from its tight sling against leather battle webbing. The assault harness is festooned with everything from a wide-bladed utility parang to a gas mask hood with flares for a signal gun at his hip and a camel water bladder over his shoulder. A veteran of the Razors would note the distinctly non-regulation moccasins on his feet and infer that the Razor's operations officer, Major Valentine, was back from another of his scouts. David Valentine breathed in a last snootful of clean air and descended into the muskrat den reek. He stepped down carefully, holding an uprooted young dandelion in his gun-free hand. The stairwell to the old terminal's sub-level was mostly gone. The entrance to the Razorback's headquarters resembled an oversized anthole, if anything. It fooled the eyes that sometimes drifted high above the besiegers' positions. He rested his gun in a cleaning becket and stood on a carpet remnant in the entryway to let his eyes adjust to the dim light within. Deaf old Pooter, one of the regiment's guinea pigs, rolled up onto his hind legs and welcomed Valentine from his chicken wire cage perched on a shelf next to the door. Valentine tossed him the dandelion.
They didn't hit us after all.
The length of milky dandelion stem disappeared into Pooter's fast-working jaws. If the Currians dusted again, Pooter would expire in a noisy hacking fit, giving the men inside time to ring the alarm, lower the plastic curtains, and put on their gas masks and gloves. Valentine was tired. He'd spent the last 8 hours moving across the forward posts, keyed up for a battle that never came. Probably more than he would have been had there been action. The weird, "I'm alive and I can do anything" exhilaration of surviving combat would have floated him back to the Razor's HQ. The bear Valentine knew as Lost and Found stood just outside the cubbyhole in the deepest shadow of the entrance, an assault rifle resting in his arms like a cradled child, a bucket filled with white powder at his feet. Valentine took in the HQ air, perhaps 10 degrees warmer than the morning chill of the Texas spring outside. The bear tobacco, a faint fecal smell, brewing coffee, old sweat, drying laundry, gun oil, and a hint of cabbage stewing in salty broth rolled around in his nostrils.
Morning, sir.
Lost and Found looked out the door beyond Valentine. He prodded the bucket at his foot. Valentine dutifully stripped off his combat harness and tossed it in the decontamination barrel. The rest of his clothes followed until he stood naked on the carpet remnant. He took a handful of the boric acid from the bucket and gave himself a rubdown, concentrating on his shoulder-length black hair, armpits, and crotch. Red nits liked the warmth and tender apertures around hair follicles, and the battalion wasn't losing any more men to nit fever. Colonel Meadows had enough on his hands with 20% of the Razorbacks filling field hospital beds or recovery wards, eating leek and liver soup twice daily, getting their blood back up to strength. Valentine went over to a bank of lockers featuring names written on duct tape, plastered on new paint, slathered over old rust, and extracted a uniform. Hank had put a fresh one in overnight, while Valentine was forward. Regular soldiers had to make do with the rumpled contents of the slop bins, but the Razorback officers each had a locker for their inside uniforms. When he was properly dressed in the mixed gray and deep green fatigues of the Razorbacks, Southern Command Mixed Infantry Division, for use of. Some said the color scheme was reminiscent of a raccoon's backside. He put on leather-soled moccasins and followed the smell of coffee with his wolf's nose. He walked past the headset-wearing HQ radio field phone operator, whose gear was swathed in cheesecloth that smelled of kerosene, surrounded by six different no-smoking signs in English, Spanish, and French. The kerosene kept the electrics out. The little bastards ate electrical insulation and grew into three-inch stick-like bugs whose metallic chitin inevitably shorted out electrical equipment. The boy with the headset, 17 but scrawny enough to pass for 14, studied the flickering needles of the radio set as though divining runes. Valentine raised an eyebrow to the kid, got a head shake in return, and looked at the clipboard with the most recent comm flimsies. There had been some chatter out of Dallas the previous day that made GHQ Dallas Corridor suspect a counterattack in the Razorbacks area, but nothing had manifested last night. Valentine had a room to himself down among the original plumbing fixtures and electrical junction boxes. In the distance, a generator worked, steadily supplying juice. Just along the hall, Colonel Meadows occupied an old security office, but Valentine didn't see light creeping out from under the door, so he turned and moved aside the bedsheet curtaining off his quarters. His nose told him someone lay in his room, even before his eyes picked out the L-shaped hummock in his wire-frame bed. A pale, boric acid-dusted leg, ending in a calloused hammer-toed foot, emerged from the woolly army blanket, and a knife-cut shock of short red hair could just be distinguished at the other end. Alessa Duvalier was back from the heart of Dallas. Valentine examined the foot. Some people showed the experience of a hard life through their eyes, others in their rough hands. A few, like Narcisse, were bodily crippled. While the rest of Duvalier was rather severely pretty, occasionally exquisite when mood or necessity struck, Duvalier's feet manifested everything bad the cat had been through. Dark with filth between the toes, hard-heeled, toes twisted and dirt-crusted, nails chipped, scabbed at the ankle, calloused and scarred from endless miles on worn-through socks, her feet told a gruesome tale. A pair of utility sinks held her gear, reeking of the camphor smell of its spell in the decontamination barrel, her sword-concealing walking stick lying atop more mundane boots and socks. She shifted, and he caught a flash of upper thigh. She'd fallen into his bed wearing only a slop shirt. They'd never been lovers, but were as comfortable around each other as a married couple.
Val? That you?
Yeah.
Room for two.
Shower first, then I want to hear...
Oh, one more hour. I got in at 04.
I was out at the forward posts. Pickets didn't report you.
Valentine heard Hank's quick step on the stairs he'd just come down. He looked at his self-winding watch, a gift from Meadows when the colonel assumed command of the Razorbacks. The engraved inscription on the back proclaimed 48-year-old eternal love between a set of initials both ending in C.
One more hour, then. Breakfast?
Anything.
Working a soapy rag up and down his legs, Valentine took a reviving spout shower that kept Hank busy bearing hot water down from the kitchen. Valentine had been seeing to the boy's education at odd hours, trying to remember the lessons Father Max had issued at 13, and had put him in the battalion's books to make it easier to feed and clothe the boy. They shared more than just a working relationship. Both had ugly red and white burn scars, Valentine's on his back, Hank's on his semi-functional right hand.
What's the definition of an isosceles triangle?
Two sides of equal length.
When are all three the same?
Equilateral.
Hank also got the questions on degrees of the corners of an equilateral right. Tomorrow, Valentine would get him using triangles for navigational purposes. It always helped to add practical applicability right away. In a week or so, the boy would be able to determine latitude using the sun and a sextant, providing he could remember the definition of a plumb line.
Haven't seen Ankar this morning, have you?
No, sir.
Valentine hadn't smelled the Grog's presence at headquarters, but Ankar kept to himself in a partially blocked stairwell when he was at the headquarters. Ankar was evaluating and drilling some of the newer Razorbacks, mostly Texan volunteers who'd been funneled to them through Southern Command's haphazard field personnel depot north of the city. Southern Command tended to get recruits the all-Texan units didn't want, and Ankar knew how to turn lemons into lemonade. The first thing Valentine wanted recruits to learn was to respect Grogs, whether they were friends or enemies. Way too many lives had been lost in the past, thanks to mistakes.
Go ahead and fill a tray.
Yes, sir.
Valentine saw that the light was on in Meadows' office and poked his head in to see if his superior had anything new on the rumored attack.
Forward posts, all quiet, sir.
I'm not forward or quiet. Narcisse made her chilly last night.
William Post, Valentine's old subordinate, an ex-Quisling coastal marine who'd helped him take the Thunderbolt across the Caribbean and back, and was one of the best officers he'd ever known, went back to sorting comm flimsies.
Anything happen here?
Meadows had the look of a man just up from a 20-minute nap that was the only sleep he'd gotten that night. He closed his shirt, his missing-fingered hand working the buttons up the seam like a busy insect.
Not even the usual harassing fire. They're finally running out of shells. Big wings overhead in the night.
Big wings were the larger gargoyle-like flyers the Kurians kept in the taller towers of Dallas. Both smarter and rarer than the harpies Valentine had encountered, they tended to stay above, out of rifle shot, in the dark. Some weeks ago, Valentine had seen a dead one that had been brought down by chance, wearing a pair of binoculars and carrying an aerial photograph, grease-penciled icons squiggled all over the photo marking the besieging army's current positions.
I had the A Company men turn in. The armored cars are still ready to roll, and C Company's alerted, just in case.
Thanks, Will. Colonel, I still think they're preparing a surprise. I'd suggest we keep the line fully manned.
Our sources could be wrong, again.
Meadows glanced at the flimsy basket next to his door. It was piled with messages that came in overnight but weren't important enough to require the CO to be awakened. The belief that an attack was due had been based on Valentine's intelligence, everything from deserter interrogations to vague murmurs from Dallas operations that the heart of the city was abuzz with activity. There was no hint of reprimand or peevishness in his tone. Meadows knew war was guesswork, and frequently the guesses were wrong.
Sir, smoke came in while I was out. I'll debrief her over breakfast.
How are the men up the boulevard doing?
The boulevard was a wide east-west street that marked the forward edge of the Razors' positions. Snipers and machine gunners warred over five lanes of former Texas State Route from blasted storefronts. Comparatively fresh companies had been moved up in anticipation of the attack from the relative quiet of the old field.
Unhappy about being on the line, sir. They only got 3 days at the airfield.
Let's rotate them out if nothing happens by tomorrow morning.
Will do, sir.
I'll see to smoke now, Colonel, if you don't have anything else.
Thank her for me, Major. Grab a meal and then hit your bunk.
Meadows picked up the flimsies from his basket, glanced at them, and passed them to Valentine. Valentine read them on the way back to the galley, or kitchen, he mentally corrected. Shipboard slang still worked itself into his thoughts, a leftover from his year-long spell posing as a coastal marine in the enemy's uniform, and then living in the Thunderbolt after taking her from the Kurians. 0130, potable water line reestablished to forward positions. 0228, OP3, OP11, artillery fire flashes and sounds from other side of city. 0355, OP3, barrage ceased. 0410, OP12 reports train heard north toward city. The OP notation was for field phone-equipped forward observation posts. Valentine had heard the barrage and seen the flashes on the opposite side of the city as well, glimpsed from between the tall buildings, making the structures stand out against the night like gravestones to a dead city. The only suspicious message was of the train. The lines into Dallas had been cut, torn up, mined, plowed under, or otherwise blocked very early in the siege. Readying or moving a train made little sense, unless the Kurians were merely shuffling troops within the city. After loading up a tray and employing Hank as a coffee bearer, Valentine returned to his room. Duvalier twitched at his entry, then relaxed. Her eyes opened.
Food.
And coffee.
Valentine set the tray briefly on the bed before pulling his makeshift desk up so she'd have an eating surface. Hank hung up Duvalier's gear to dry.
What's the latest from D?
No sign of an assault. I saw some extra gun crews and battle police at their stations, but no troops have been brought up.
The Quislings?
Most units been on half rations for over a month now. Internal security and battle police accepted, of course, and some of the higher officers are as fat as ever. I heard some men talking. No one dares report sick. Rumor has it the Kurians are running short on aura, and the sick list is the first place they look.
Morale?
Oh, horrible. Mm. They're losing, and they know it. Deserters aren't being disposed of quietly anymore. Every night, just before they shut down power, they assemble representatives from all the Quisling brigades and have public executions. I put on a nurse's shawl and hat and watched one. NCOs kept offering me a bottle or cigarettes, but I couldn't take my eyes off the stage. They make the deserters stand in these big plastic garbage cans, the ones with little arrows running around in a circle, handcuffed in front. Then a Reaper comes up from behind one and tears open their shirt. They keep the poor bastard facing the other ranks the whole time so they can see the expression on his face. They're all gagged, of course. They don't want any last words. The Reaper clamps its jaws somewhere between the shoulder blades and starts squeezing their arms into the ribcage. You hear the bones breaking. See the shoulders pop out as they dislocate. Then they just tip up the garbage can and wheel the body away. Blood and piss leaking out of the bottom, usually. Then a political officer steps up and reads the dead man's confession, and a CO verifies his mark or signature. Then they wheel out the next one. Sometimes six or seven a night. They want the men to go to bed with something to think about. I seen some god-awful stuff, but that poor bastard. I had a dream about him.
They never run out of Reapers, do they?
Seems not.
Okay, they're not massing for an attack. Maybe a breakout?
No, all the rolling motor stock is dispersed, unless it's hidden. I saw a few entrances to underground garages that were guarded with armored cars and lots of wire and kneecappers.
The last was a nasty little mine the Kurians were fond of. When triggered, it launched itself 20 inches in the air like a startled frog and exploded, sending flechettes out horizontally that literally cut a man off at the knees.
I don't suppose you saw any draft articles of surrender crumpled up in the wastebaskets, did you?
Nah.
Now, if you'll get out of my bed...
I need a real bath. Those basins are hardly big enough to sit in. How about your water boy?
You can use the women's. There's piping laid and a tub.
Killjoy.
The alarms brought Valentine out of his dreams and to his feet. Alarms. Basement in Texas. Dallas siege. The Razors. Alarms? Two alarms, his brain noted as full consciousness returned. Whistle after whistle, blown from a dozen mouths like referees trying to stop a football brawl, indicated an attack. All men to grab whatever would shoot and get to their defense stations, plus the wail of an air alert siren. But no gongs. If the Kurians had dusted again, every man who could find a piece of hollow metal to bang, from tin can to wheel rim, should be setting up as loud a clamor as possible. No one wanted to be a weak link in another Fort Worth massacre that caused comrades to choke out. Valentine forced himself to pull on socks and tie his boots, grabbed the bag containing his gas mask, scarves, and gloves anyway, and buckled his pistol belt. Hank had cleaned and hung up his cut-down battle rifle. Valentine checked it over as he hurried through men running every which way or looking to their disheveled operations officer for direction and headed for the stairs to the control tower, the field's tactical command post. He took seemingly endless switchbacks of stairs, two at a time, to the top deck, the Razor's shorthand for the tallest point of Love Field. He felt explosions, then heard them a second later. Worse than mortars, worse than artillery, and going off so closely together, he wondered if the Kurians had been keeping rocket artillery in reserve for a crisis. The old stairs rattled and dropped dirt as though shaking in fear.
Send to headquarters! Rancid! Rancid!
Brigade, alert! Rancid! Rancid! Brigade, alert! Rancid! Rancid! Brigade!
Valentine came off the last stairs and passed through the open security door. Meadows and two others of the regiment had box seats on chaos. Whoever had installed the glass, if it was glass and not a high-tech polymer, had done the job well. Still intact windows offered the tower a 360-degree field of vision. In the distance, the crenellated Dallas skyline, one bifurcated tower the men called the Eye, stared straight at the field, thanks to its strange, empty-centered top, broke the hazy morning horizon. As he went to the glass, another explosion erupted in black-orange menace atop the parking garage, the biggest structure on the field.
Would you look at those bastards?
Valentine followed a private's eyes up and looked out on a sky filled with whirling planes. Not rickety rebuilt crop dusters or lumbering old commercial aircraft. The assorted planes shared only smooth silhouettes and a mottled gray and tan camouflage pattern reminiscent of a dusty rattlesnake. There were sleek single-seaters, like stunt planes Valentine had seen in books, whipping around the edges of the field, turned sideways so the pilots could get a good look at ground activity. Banana-shaped twin-engine jobs dove in at the vehicles parked between the two wings of the terminal concourses, one shooting rocket after rocket at the vehicles, while the other two flanked it, drawing ground fire. A pair of bigger, uglier, wide-winged military attack planes with bulging turbofans on their rear fuselages came in, dropping a series of bombs that exploded into a huge snake of fire, writhing between the Razor's positions and the southwestern strip.
Who the hell are these guys?
The screaming machines, roaring to and fro over the field, weren't the only attackers on the wing. Flying grogs in the hundreds, many of the Harpy type Valentine had first met over weaning during his spell in the labor regiments, swooped below the aircraft and even the control tower, dispensing what looked and exploded like sticks of dynamite at anything that moved. A few bigger wings, the true gargoyles of the kind Valentine had seen laid out, circled above, possibly waiting for a juicy enough target to be worth whatever they held in saddlebags hung around their thick necks. The Razors fought back, mostly from their positions in the parking garages and the heavy weapons point near the entrance to the terminal buildings. Small groups of men or single soldiers fired from behind doorways, windows, or the sandbagged positions guarding the motor pool between the concourses. Valentine heard something hit the roof with the scrabble of claws.
Out!
The trio looked up at the roof, apparently transfixed by the harmless scrabbling noises. Meadow's hand went to his sidearm, and the private fumbled with his battle rifle. In seconds, they'd be dead, fragmenting brain tissue, still wondering at the strange raccoon-like noise.
Out!
Valentine bodily pushed the private to the stairs with one hand and pulled the communications officer from her chair with the other. She came out of her chair with her headset on, the headset cord stretched and unplugged as though it were as reluctant to leave its post as its operator. Meadows moved with dramatic suddenness as the realization of what might be happening on the roof arrived and grabbed for the handle on the thick metal door to the stairway.
I'll get it.
Valentine, keeping touch with both the private and the communications officer, hurried down the stairs. One flight, two flights. Meadows' clattering footsteps on the stairs a half floor above. The boom Valentine had been expecting for 10 anxious seconds was not head-shattering, and while it shook peeling paint from the stairs and knocked out the lights, the three weren't so much as knocked off stride. Meadows joined them.
The door must have held.
Maybe.
The impact of three more explosions came up through the floor, bombs striking Love Field somewhere.
Orders? I'm going back up. They might think they finished the job with one bomb. The radio antennas had it for sure, but the field lines might still be functional.
You two game?
Valentine asked the private, an intelligent soldier named Wilcox, who was the military equivalent of a utility infielder. He could play a variety of positions well. Ruvayed, the lieutenant with the headphone jack still swinging at the end of its cord just below her belt, nodded. Valentine clicked his gun off safety and brought it to his shoulder.
Me first, in case they crawled in.
Meadows brought up the rear, going back up the stairs. Valentine reached the security door. Dust had been blown from beneath the door in an elegant spiked pattern, and he smelled smoke and the harsher odor of burning plastic. He turned the handle, but the door wouldn't budge. A kick opened it. The air inside had the harsh, faintly sulfurous tang of exploded dynamite. As he swept the room over the open sights on his gun, Valentine saw naked sunlight streaming in from a hole in the roof big enough to put a sedan's engine block through. Older air traffic consoles and the Razor's newer communications gear were blackened and cracked. The transformation was so thorough, it seemed it should have taken more time than an instant. The glass held, though it had cracks ranging from spider webbing to single fault lines. Outside, the planes still turned, swooped, and soared, engines louder now thanks to the hole in the roof. But he kept his eyes and ears tuned to the new skylight, his cut-down Atlanta Gunworks battle rifle ready. Another tiny plane buzzed by. Who the hell are these guys? Meadows pressed binoculars to his eye, scanning the ground in the direction of Dallas.
Not even mortar fire. It's not a breakout.
Bad intelligence? They thought we had planes?
Another ribbon of fire blossomed against the parking garage facing the runway to the southwest. Valentine wondered about Anka and Will Post. Both were probably at the hard points around the garages. Why did they keep hitting that side of the airport? It faced the train tracks running out of the city, but the lines were torn up for miles. Another of the tiny, fast scout planes buzzed low over the overgrown airstrip there. Save for his speed, it looked as though he might be on a landing approach. The plane jumped skyward to avoid a stream of tracer. Meadows' binoculars trained up at some big multi-engine transport circling the field.
Wish we had some AK-AK guns here. All the high-angle stuff is close into the city.
Colonel, southwest. Look southwest, hitting hardest there.
Field phones are shot.
Wilcox, hustle us up a portable radio.
The private disappeared down the stairs. The colonel searched the southern and western approaches to the airport.
God damn!
I'd like to see what's happening in the garage.
Go ahead. Pass the word I'll be on the maintenance frequency if I can get a radio up here. Send up a couple of messengers.
Valentine handed his gun and ammunition harness to Rubiet.
Keep an eye cocked to that hole, and watch the balcony.
The control tower had an electronic service balcony just below the outsloping windows. Nothing but birds' nests and old satellite dishes decorated it. But it would be just like the gargoyles to land carrying a couple of sniper rifles.
Yes, sir.
Tell everyone to keep their heads down, Major. Maybe this whole attack is a Kurian screw-up. The mechanics moved a couple of stripped passenger craft the other day. From a distance, it could have looked like we had planes ready to go.
Yes, sir.
Valentine turned for the stairs. Meadows didn't care one way or the other about salutes.
That advice goes doubly for you.
The violent air show going on outside must have been running short on fireworks. Only one more small explosion sounded during the endless turns down the stairs. The elevator to the control tower was missing and presumed scavenged. Nothing but shaft ran up the center of the structure. Valentine double-timed through the tunnel system and up to the first floor of the terminal. He trotted past empty counters under faded signs and motionless luggage carousels. The only part of the main terminal in use was a small area in front of the bronze ranger statue. One riot, one ranger, read the plaque, where the consumables for the razors were delivered every few days. A corporal with his flak jacket on inside out called from the other end of the terminal.
Major, they're herding on the west approach.
Thanks. Tell the bears to find Captain Post and be ready to counterattack if they hit us from the ground. Send messengers and a new field phone up to the top deck, right away.
The corporal nodded and ran for the stairwell. Valentine crossed over to the huge parking garages by scuttling under the concrete walkway to the upper deck of the lot. A wheelless ambulance in the center of the parking garage served as an improvised command post for the airport's close-in defense. The air was full of smoke, and a fainter, oilier smell Valentine recognized as burning gasoline. Wounded men and burned corpses lay all around the ambulance. Captain Martin, a Texas liaison for the Razors, helped the medics perform the gruesome task of triage as he spoke to a pair of sergeants.
Everyone to the dugouts but the observers. And yes, treat it like a bombardment. We'll worry about an assault when we see one.
Weird kind of visit from Dallas. How'd they pull this off?
I doubt they're from Dallas. We would have seen them taken off.
I'm putting the men in the shelters.
Good. I'd like to take a look at that field south and west of here. Is there still an operational post where I can do that?
Valentine saw Anka approaching from a forward garage stairwell, a man draped on each powerful shoulder. Anka's arms, longer than but not quite as thick as his legs, held the men in place in a strange imitation of the classic bodybuilder's pose. Blood matted his friend's golden shoulder and back fur as his old companion set the men down near the ambulance. Anka checked the dressings on the men he had just set down. Enormous, double-thumbed hands gently turned one of the wounded on his side. The golden one nodded to one of the Razor medics as she wiped her hands on a blood-stained disinfectant towel and squatted beside the latest additions to the swamp of bleeding men.
He's worth 3 Texans. That's 10 ordinary men, in other words.
The observation post?
Second floor of the garage, back of an old van. Still wired to the phone network.
I know it. Anka!
Yes, my David?
Get your puddler and meet me at OP6.
Anka's grog gun had become famous, a 20-millimeter behemoth of his own design that resembled a telescope copulating with a sawed-off kid's swing set. The other name came from a skirmish the Razors fought outside Fort Worth, where Anka reduced an armored car commander to a slippery puddle of goo outside his hatch at 600 yards.
Yes, my David. I had to leave Corporal Lopez at the stairwell exterior door. He's dead. Or soon will be.
Well, what the hell, Major? What's so goddamn important about blowing us off the planet?
We'll know sooner than we'd like, I expect.
Right!
Make sure the men have their dust gear in the shelters.
Valentine ran down a mental list of what else the Razors might need to stop a column, and the two reserve regimental recoilless rifles could be useful.
Get Luke and John operational up here too, with plenty of shells, but dust gear first.
Matthew and Mark were vehicle-mounted, and probably smoldering with most of the other transport between the terminals.
They're probably on their way already.
Valentine offered a salute. Martin's mouth tightened as he returned it. The Texans weren't big on military rigmarole, but there were ordinary soldiers present, and the Razors knew a salute from their operations chief meant that the half-Indian major didn't expect you to speak again until you were ready to report on his orders, and hurried to the central stairway. Valentine went up a floor to the last garage level before the exposed top and hurried to the rusty old van, parked just far enough from the open edge of the parking lot so the sun would never hit it. Though wheelless and up on blocks, missing even its headlamps and mirrors, the Razors kept it clean so that the carefully washed, smoked glass windows at the back and sides wouldn't stand out from the dirt and Texas dust of the non-lethal variety.
Valentine approaching!
Valentine entered the van through the open side door. Two Razors looked out on the Dallas skyline and the roads and train tracks running along the western edge of the airfield. Their ready dust hoods hung off the backs of their helmets like bridal veils. Dropped playing cards lay on the van's interior carpet, the only remaining evidence of what had probably once been plush fixtures for road-weary vacationers.
I've never seen so many planes in my life, that's for sure. Howdy, Major.
Hey, Major Valentine, we got hit after all, huh?
I'm glad somebody noticed. Did it break up a good card game?
Depends. Lewis was winning.
Sorry to hear that, Lewis.
What do these air cutters got against the Razors is what I want to know.
Valentine scanned the approaches to the airfield, then the sky. A larger plane, its wingspan wider than its body length, caught the sun high up. Whoever's up there knows. The second phase of the attack came within 5 minutes, as Valentine reported to Meadows through a field phone line, patched into the portable radio now installed in the control tower.
Holy Jesus!
The grass between the northwest-southeast parallel runways flanking the field bulged, then dimpled, then collapsed, sending a cloud of dirt to join the smoke still coating the field.
Between the runways!
Anka was positioned at a supporting column. And unnecessarily, as Valentine locked eyes on the spot and brought up his binoculars, a corkscrew prow the size of one of the old Thunderbolt's lifeboats emerged into daylight. Striped blacks and browns on a pebbly organic surface spun hypnotically as it rotated. Brown flesh behind, the snout pulsed, ripples like circular waves traveling backward to the hidden portion of the thing. It rolled like a show diver performing a forward twist and nosed back into the earth. Overgrown prairie plants flew as the giant worm tilled and plunged back into the soil.
What the devil?
Tiny planes whipped over the inverted U of exposed flesh. Valentine consulted the map of the airfield and its surroundings pinned to the carpeted wall of the observation van.
Tunnels, Colonel. They've tunneled to the airfield. We need fire support to grid N7. Repeat, N7.
The tunneling worm's other end finally appeared, another shell-like counterpoint to the prow. Valentine marked an orifice at the very tip this time, though whether it was for eating or excreting, he couldn't say. The two identical warcraft, turbofans bulging above their broad wings, banked in from the west, aiming directly at the parking garages. Valentine dropped the field glasses and the phone handpiece. Something about the cross-like silhouettes of the aircraft suggested approaching doom.
This won't be good.
Out! Out! Out!
Anka was already at the van door, perhaps ready to bodily pull them in from the observation post, but the three jumped from the van and ran for the central stairway. They didn't quite make it. The men flung themselves down, recognizing the rockets for what they were. The planes had aimed for the floor beneath theirs, as it turned out. The van caught some of the blast from below. Their carpeted cubbyhole tipped on its side, blown off its blocks.
Let's see if the phone's still working.
What if they come around for another pass?
They gotta be out of fireworks by now.
Valentine looked up at Anka, who was inspecting his puddler.
You all right, old horse?
Yes. The sight may be out of alignment. I dropped it in my haste.
Back at the edge of the garage, in the shadow of a supporting column, Valentine met Anka's eyes before cautiously peeping over the edge of the parking lot wall and surveying the field. Helicopters. Gradually, Valentine made out shapes through the obscuring smoke of still-burning jellied gasoline and the more recent rocket blasts. A great sand-colored behemoth with twin rotors forward and a smaller stabilizing fan aft thundered out of the west. Smaller helicopters flanked her, like drones looking to mate with some great queen bee. One of the little stunt planes flew in, dropping a canister near the holes. It sputtered to life on impact and threw a streamer of red smoke into the sky. Where's the damn artillery? Lewis extracted the canvas-covered pack from the van.
Field phone's still good, Major.
Spot for artillery if it's available. Target that cherry bomb by the holes and send base defense southwest to Colonel Meadows.
Base defense southwest, yes, sir!
Another plane roared by, seemingly inches from the garage, with a suddenness that momentarily stopped Valentine's heart.
I do not like these airplanes.
Valentine watched the smaller helicopters shoot off more rockets, but these just sent up more thick clouds of smoke, putting a dark gray wall between the observation point and the holes.
If we can't see them, set up the Puddler. Lewis, any word on the artillery?
Sounds like they've been hit too, sir.
The twin-rotored helicopter blew just enough smoke away with its massive blades so they could get a quick look at it as it landed by the hole.
That's your target. See the smaller rotor spinning at the end of the tail? Aim for the center of that.
Smoke obscured the quick glance, but Valentine had seen something emerge from the hole dug by the worm, a turtle-like shape.
Our mortars, anything, get it put down on that hole.
Nothing to shoot at, my David.
Tell Meadows it's a breakout. I think the Kurians are trying to run for it with the helicopters.
Why didn't they just land on a street in Dallas?
We've got high-angle artillery there.
Sir!
The smoke clouds cleared. Some kind of bay doors had opened at the rear of the massive helicopter, which rested on thick-tired multiple wheels. The turtle-like thing, which looked to Valentine like a greenish propane storage tank, crawling across the runway without benefit of wheels, tracks, or legs, had turned for the big chopper. Ankah's gun coughed, and Valentine's nose registered cordite. Ankah didn't bother to watch the shot. Instead, he drew another highlighter-sized bullet from his bandolier and reloaded the gun. But the smoke was back. Valentine could just make out the helicopter through the thinning smoke. Explosions sounded from back toward the terminal as another piece of the Razor military machine was blown up. Ankah must have been able to see the rear rotor for a second. He fired again. Valentine marked the strange tank-like thing entering the rear of the helicopter. It was like watching a film of a hen laying an egg run backward.
Where's the fucking support?
Valentine heard engines on the ground. He looked to the south, where a few of the Razor's strange conglomeration of transport and patrol vehicles, including two prowlers, were barreling past the Statue of Flight at the edge of the airport buildings.
Whee! Holy shit, the cavalry!
Valentine recognized the salt and pepper hair of the man at the minigun in the lead prowler, Captain William Post. The aircraft spotted the vehicles too. A twin-engine airplane swooped in, firing cannon at the column. Valentine saw one big-tire transport turn and plow into the garage. Ankah fired again, and the helicopter wobbled as it left the ground, rear doors still closing. The helicopter lurched sideways. Perhaps Ankah had damaged the rear rotor after all. The pilot managed to get the helicopter, which was skittering sideways across the field like a balky horse, righted. Light caught Valentine's eyes from above, and he looked up to see muzzle flash from a big four-engine aircraft above. Some kind of gun fired on the approaching vehicles. But the Razors had guns of their own, and someone trained them on the staggering helicopter. Machine guns and small cannon opened up, sending pieces of fuselage flying. Black smoke blossomed from the craft's engine crown, instantly dispersed by the powerful rotors. Ankah shot again. The Razor vehicles had to pay for their impertinent charge. The military turbofan planes swooped in. Valentine grimly noted a desert camouflage pattern atop the craft, and fired from some kind of cannon that created a muzzle flash as big as the blunt nose of the aircraft, planting blossoms of fiery destruction among the Razor attackers. Post's armored car turned over as it died. Valentine couldn't imagine what the wreck had done to his friend. Like sacrificing a knight to take the enemy queen, even as the prowlers exploded, the double-rotored helicopter tipped sideways, sending its six blades spinning into the smoke-filled sky as it crashed. The helicopter's crew jumped out with credible speed, and Ankah swiveled his cannon.
No! I want prisoners!
One of the smaller helicopters swooped in and landed, even as tracer fire began to appear from the positions at the base of the garage, where gun slits had been clawed through the concrete weeks ago. Ankah shifted his aim and began to send 20mm cannon shells into the tail rotor of the rescue helicopter. The concrete to the left of Ankah exploded into powdery dust.
Down!
Valentine threw himself sideways onto Ankah. Cannon shells tore through the gap between the floors of the garage, ripping apart the van. The Arkansan fell, with a softball-sized hunk of flesh torn away from his neck and shoulder, and Valentine dully thought that he'd have to learn the man's name in order to put it in the report. And then the cannonade was over. Lewis stared stupidly around, still kneeling next to the van, in the exact same position he'd been in a second ago, still holding the field phone to his ear. Valentine heard the first shell fire landing on the field. The artillery had come at last. Valentine stood between the shell holes on the overgrown, cracked landing strip and surveyed the mess. What was left of the attackers from the vehicles and the defenders of the garages had encircled the two holes and the downed helicopter. Valentine had seen Post borne away in a stretcher, but couldn't do anything but touch a bloodily peeled hand as the bearers rushed him to the medical unit. The mysterious air raiders had rocketed their own helicopter before leaving, blowing what was left of the double-rotor airship into three substantial chunks, pilot cabin, part of the cargo area, and stabilizing tail. The odd green propane tank capsule remained in the wreckage. Flames slid off it like oil from Teflon. The bears kept watch from the overturned earth of the Kurian wormhole. Valentine had poked his head in. The 3-meter diameter tunnel was ringed with strands of whitish goo about the thickness of his thumb, crisscrossed and spiderwebbed like the frosting dribbling atop a bundt cake. Whether the digging worm creature, someone called it a boar worm, but Valentine didn't know if the term came from Hitchens' Guide to Introduced Species or if the would-be zoologist had thought it up on the spot. The bears also watched a pair of wounded prisoners, survivors of the transport helicopter who hadn't made it to the rescuing craft. A medic dressed a cut on one pilot's scalp just below the helmet line. The strangers submitted to the ministrations with something like dull contempt. The air crew were lean, well-tanned men with oversized sunglasses and desert scarves. Both wore leather jackets with a panel stitched on the back, reading in English and Spanish. Non-negotiable $10,000 gold reward for the safe return of this pilot, unharmed and healthy, to Pip's Flying Circus, Yuma, Arizona, Astland. Negotiable traveling and keep expenses also paid in trade goods. Contact Provost Fort Chico or New Universal Church Tempe Directorate for information and directions. Each also had a patch reading, Pip's Flying Circus, featuring a winged rattlesnake, flying with mouth open as though to strike. So, the question of who the hell are these guys was answered, with another question. But Valentine's mind was on that tank in the center of the wreckage. Some of the men theorized it contained a nuclear bomb. Valentine suspected that the contents were a good deal more lethal to the human race long term. And everyone was looking at him. Valentine paced at the edge of the wormhole and then stopped and turned to Nail, a pigeon-chested bear with long sun-lightened blonde hair wearing captain's bars. Nail had been promoted after the fight on Big Rock Mountain and was the leader of the toughest soldiers in the Razors, and probably Texas, in Valentine's opinion. And that meant the world, if you ask a Texan. But Valentine had learned not to argue with Texans in matters of regional pride.
Nail, I want 3 bears ready with demolition blocks. I don't know if it'll dent that thing, but it might rattle them.
Ready? Send them forward now.
No, I'm gonna have a talk with them first.
That's your aura, Val.
Anka lifted his improvised cannon.
I'll go along, my David.
Valentine looked around and pointed to a scrawny, fuzzy-cheeked Razor.
You come too, Apley.
Yes, sir.
Valentine passed the boy his order book.
We get some kind of dialogue going. I want you to look like you're taking notes.
You want me to write down what they say?
If you want. Write your mom if you want. I just want you writing when anybody is talking. Can do?
Can do.
Great. Follow a little behind.
Why such a youngster?
Would you use that boy in an ambush?
Of course not.
I hope the Kurians think that too.
When he figured he was close enough, Valentine stopped and looked around at his feet. The Kurian vessel reminded him now of a pill rather than a propane tank, or perhaps a malformed watermelon. The top half was a bit bigger than the bottom. Some kind of bright blue sludge clung to the bottom.
Reminds me of heartroot, come to maturity in a drought.
Heartroot was a mushroom-like grog staple. Valentine picked up a piece of shattered glass and threw it at the tank. It bounced off. Valentine noted that the blue sludge shrunk away from the vibration. Perhaps a Kurian? They were bluish on the rare instances when they appeared undisguised. But why would it be hiding outside the tank?
Anyone home?
The blue sludge quivered, shifted up the faintly lined side of the tank vessel. The lines reminded Valentine of the nautical charts and plots he'd seen on the old Thunderbolt.
I've come to negotiate your relocation from Texas.
Valentine looked over his shoulder. The boy was scribbling. The blue goop bulged, then parted. Valentine recognized a Reaper emerging from the protoplasm. The 2-meter-tall death machines were living organisms linked to their master Kurian, used in the messy and sometimes dangerous process of aura extraction. The Reaper fed off the victim's blood using a syringe-like tongue, while the Kurian animating it absorbed what Old Father Max had called aural energies. Others called it soul-sucking. Is that how they make them? The Reaper climbed out of the blue sludge and lifted its hood, pulling it far forward over its face to block out the sun. Sunlight didn't kill them, unfortunately, but it interfered with their senses and the connection with the Master Kurian. Valentine silently wished for one of Ankh-Ah's quickwood spear points or crossbow bolts. 2 years ago, Valentine had brought a special kind of olive tree-like growth called quickwood back from the Caribbean. It was lethal to Reapers, but had been consumed in the insurrection in the Ozarks known as Operation Archangel the previous year.
Look, they shot out a Reaper.
Ankh-Ah raised his long gun just a fraction. Valentine revised his estimate of the interior of the tank. At one Reaper per Kurian, there could be only a dozen or so Reapers inside the tank. The flexible, octopus-crossed-with-back Kurians could squeeze into nooks and crannies, of course, but the impressively built Reapers could only be packed so tight. And all breathed oxygen. At one Reaper per Kurian, there was a theory that without at least one Reaper to supply it with aura, a Kurian starved to death. That meant a dozen Kurians.
Far enough.
As the Reaper approached, Ankh-Ah raised his gun a little higher. The Reaper stayed out of grabbing distance.
I shall speak for those within, foodling.
Use the word foodling again, and those within will have to crap out a new negotiator.
Your terms.
First, you left behind a lot of men in Dallas. Tell them to surrender without another shot fired. No conditions, but officers and military police will be allowed to keep their sidearms. The combatants can keep individual weapons. Non-combatants will be under protection of their own people. We're not taking them into custody. They can march wherever they want on whatever supplies they can bring out of Dallas. Second, what's left of Dallas, including artillery and transport, shall be turned over to us, intact. If both those conditions are met, we'll load your tin can on a transport and take you to any border region you'd like, along with any remaining of your kind that didn't manage to tunnel out of the city.
Valentine knew he had overstepped his authority. In fact, this was more like running a track and field triple jump over his authority, but he wanted to make the deal before the Kurians had time to call for some other form of help. For all he knew, flying saucers might already be on their way.
We no longer control Dallas. Certain handlers remain within, but the skulking soldiers of your breed inside are increasingly obstinate.
Not my problem.
We shall consider.
Don't consider too long. In 15 minutes, we're going to try high explosives. If that doesn't work, we'll start piling tires around your capsule. Then we'll douse everything in gasoline and light it. You better have good air filtration equipment in there. You burn oxygen same as us, and a good tire bonfire can go for weeks.
The Reaper twitched in the direction of Valentine, and Ankh-Ah shouldered his gun. But instead of the expected attack, the Reaper lurched backward toward the capsule and acted out a strange pantomime, or perhaps a game of charades where jumping spider was the answer. It lurched, it spun, it backbent. Valentine heard his order book hit the ground behind him. The Reaper fell over, then picked itself up. It returned to its previous position facing the three humans, holding itself stiffly and moving off balance like a marionette with tangled strings.
We agree.
It toppled over again.
I'd have given two more fingers to have seen that.
That night, there was a celebration in the meeting room of an abandoned motel. Meadows rattled the ice in his glass. An orderly refilled it from an amber-colored bottle and disappeared back into the throng of officers and civilians at the celebration. The old Sheraton next to the interstate had seen better days. To Valentine, it smelled of sweat, sour cooking oil, and roaches, but perhaps never such a universally happy crowd. Valentine didn't feel like celebrating. William Post, possibly his best friend in the world apart from Ankh-Ah, had been maimed as he led the assault on the helicopters. The surgeons were fighting to save his life, along with those of the other wounded. Luckily, that was the only fighting going on. The army of the North Texas Cooperative had marched out of its positions and then the city as the sun set.
You bet off too much, Major Valentine.
Brigadier General Quintero had refused alcohol as well. He reminded Valentine a little of the negotiating Reaper, One side of his body sagged a little, thanks to an old shell fragment that had severed muscle in his shoulder.
I can just tolerate those Dallas scoundrels relocating, but I don't like the idea of Texas truckers carrying that fish tank to Arizona.
Valentine liked Quintero, and if the general was speaking to him in this manner, he could imagine what had been said to the general since the afternoon, when Dallas broke out in white flags and the frontline troops cautiously advanced into the city.
Could I make a suggestion, General?
Eiderdown quilts for the Quislings?
Route the Kurian fish tank to Arizona via Dallas, with the drivers in a secure cabin cage attached to a breakaway trailer. I'll ride shotgun if you need a volunteer. And we won't be shy about telling passersby what's in back. Maybe a riot starts and you declare hostilities resumed and renegotiate the surrender more advantageously. Maybe the Kurians get pulped and those Dallas troops get convinced that the only way they'll ever be safe again is to throw in with us.
You are a mean son of a bitch, Major. Excuse the expression.
I'm glad you're on our side.
Texarkana, April. The border town has turned into a staging area. Operations in the Texas Ozark United Free Region move forward as the political leadership convenes in search of a way to govern the aggregation, already being called the Two-Fur by the willfully dyslexic soldiery. A new name for the region is in the works. The city has become one of those chaotic staging areas familiar to those of long service. Units coming off frontline service bump elbows with freshly organized troops. Equipment and personnel swap by means official and unofficial, and creative middlemen set up shop to service needs ranging from new boots to old wine, aging guns to young women. Most importantly of all, a hospital has been upgraded from a bare-bones Kurian health center to a 400-bed unit that can provide care equal to any existing facility outside those patronized by the elite of the Kurian zone. Churches and temporary schools operate at the edge of Texarkana dumps, the current name for the collection of military facilities. Even the local wildlife seems to be in a state of leisurely flux. Crows and dogs and a few far-ranging seagulls trot or fly from refuse heap to sewage pit, with the local feral cats sunning themselves on wall top and windowsill after a night hunting the thriving rats and mice. The soldiers fresh from the Dallas battlefield feel the same way. Fresh food, sunshine, and sleep are all that are required for blissful, if not purring, contentment. The attenuated Razor's brief period of excited anticipation, carried since getting off the Dallas train and hearing about their billet, ended as soon as they saw the hotel. Even in its heyday, no one would have called the roadside accolade inn worthy of a special trip. The subsequent years had not been kind to the blue and white block, four stories of stucco-sided accommodations thick with kudzu and bird droppings. Sadly, the attenuated regiment fit in the hotel with beds to spare. A third of their number were dead, or in either a Fort Worth or Texarkana hospital. The latter was Valentine's first stop after getting the men to the hotel. Entering into the green peppermint tiles of the hospital, Valentine made it a point to visit every man of his command. But his mind wasn't at ease until he visited the last name on his list, Captain William Post. Visiting hours were over by the time he made it to the breezy top floor, where Post shared a room with a blinded artillery officer. Valentine showed his ID to the head nurse and signed in on the surgery recovery floor. Post looked horrible. His cheeks had shrunken in, and the nurse had done a poor job shaving him. A little tent stood over the stump of his left leg, and a tube ran from the region of his appendix to a red-filled bottle on the floor. A bottle on a hook attached to the bed dripped clear liquid into a tube in his arm, as though to balance output with input. Post's eyes were bright and alert, though.
How's it going?
They got the shrapnel out. Some small intestine came with it, so they say. No infection. Whew, no infection. That was the real worry.
You know what? They pulled maggots out of my eyes. Gotta hand it to flies. They go to work right away. I wasn't laying in the pit but 3 hours before the medics found me. Flies beat him.
He'll be out tomorrow.
How much leg is left?
Mid-thigh. At first I thought it was a raw deal. Then I decided the shrapnel could have gone 6 inches higher and to the right. It's all perspective.
We'll make a good pair, limping up and down the tent lines.
You gotta admire maggots. They know they only got one thing to do, and they do it.
I think I'll be spending the rest of the war in the first class cabin. I gotta be careful about my diet now. So they say. There's a leaflet around here somewhere.
Anything I can do for you?
Get my green duffel from under the bed.
There were only two items under the wheeled cot, a scuffed service pack and the oversized green duffel. Each had at least three kinds of tagging on it. Valentine pulled up the bag, wondering.
There's a letter case inside, little gold fittings.
It was easy to find. Everything else in the duffel was clothing. The case felt as though it was full of sand. Valentine lifted it with an effort.
Open it.
Valentine saw reams of paper inside. It was like a miniature file cabinet. Three manila folders filled it, marked in order of thickness, most to least. Queries, replies, descriptions, and evidence. Valentine caught an inky whiff of photocopier chemicals. Valentine had a good guess about the contents of the briefcase. Post had been looking for his ex-wife almost from the moment they stepped into the Ozarks. Valentine knew the details. Post had talked about her now and then when the mood hit, since the time Valentine met him while posing as a Quisling officer on the old Thunderbolt. William Post and Gail Foster had grown up in the Kurian Zone and married young. He joined the Quisling Coastal Marines, became an officer, fought and worked for the Kurians in an effort to give them a better life. But the man she thought she'd married was no collaborator. As Post's career flourished, their marriage dissolved. Gail Post became convinced he'd gone over to the enemy and left. They'd always talked of trying to make it to the Ozark Free Territory, so Post assumed she'd come here. Valentine opened the folio marked Descriptions with his forefinger. Mimeographed sheets headed Missing, Reward, had a two-toned picture of a fair young woman with wide-set eyes, photographed full face and profile. Perhaps her lips were a little too thin for her to be considered a great beauty, but then Kurian's own identification photographs rarely flattered. Post was a dedicated correspondent. Valentine guessed there had to be 200 letters and responses paper-clipped together.
There's three sheets on top of the evidence folder. Take them out, will you, Dave?
Post's head sank back on the pillow as though the effort of speaking had emptied him. Valentine knew wounds and pain. He took out the pages, bad photocopies, stamped with multiple release signatures, and waited.
I found her name. She was here.
That's a damn miracle.
I had help. After you guys got the Ozarks back, several new organizations were set up to reunite families. Then there was still the Luber Alliance.
Valentine had learned about L.A. his first year in the Ozarks. Better than 40 years old, it collected information on people lost in the Kurian Zone. Rumor had it the names numbered in the hundreds of thousands.
Luber found that first list for me.
The page had a list of names, a shipping manifest with train car allocations, 30 to a car, relatively comfortable transport by Kurian standards. Valentine didn't see a destination for the list. He flipped to the next page.
That's just an old census. Showed she lived near Pine Bluff before Solon's takeover.
Valentine had gone to a war college in Pine Bluff when the commander of Zulu Company offered him a position as lieutenant. He looked at the picture again, trying to associate it with a memory from the town. Nothing. The third page was the strangest of all. It was a photocopy of a list, and the names were handwritten. 50 names, numbered 401 to 450. Testing Station 9-P was the legend up at the top. Gail's name was in the middle, along with her age. His eyes found it quickly, thanks to an X in the column marked Result. All the other names had blanks in the Result column. Someone had handwritten, "She's gone for good," at the top corner, though whether this was a note to Post or not, none could say.
What's this?
That's the oddball. Got it about a month ago. It came in an envelope with just my address on it.
He examined the document's envelope. Typewritten, obviously with a manual typewriter. Valentine deciphered the stamp. Pine Bluff again. But the post number wasn't the one for the War College. The Miskatonic? The researchers there studied the Kurian Order, probing unpleasant shadows and gruesome corners.
No cover letter.
Nothing.
How can I help?
You know people. Life weavers. Those researchers, intelligence. I'd like to know what happened to her after she was taken, no matter how bad the news.
You sure? Maybe you don't.
She's still alive in my head.
Exactly.
No, not that way. I always knew she was alive, even when I thought you were just another CM. Can't say how I know. A feeling. I still feel it. You know about feelings like that.
Valentine did. Some inner warning system sometimes let him know when there was a Reaper around. The Valentingle, his comrades in the wolves used to call it. First as a joke. Then they learned to trust it.
I can ask around.
Post was right. He had a couple of tenuous contacts at the Miskatonic, the main scholarly center for research into the Kurian Order, and with Southern Command's intelligence. But that was pre-Solon. For all he knew, they were dead or lost in the chaos civilians were already calling the Bad Spell.
Let me know the truth. Whatever it is, Val.
Can I have these?
Sure, I copied down everything in my journal.
Listen to the doctors. Get better. The Razors need you back, even if you're stumping around on a piece of East Texas pine.
I heard they was breaking up the Razors.
From who?
Some doctor. Asked me what outfit I was with.
Probably a rumor. Lots of stuff floating around military hospitals.
Yeah! Like turds in a bedpan!
Regular Lieutenant Susie Sunshine, that guy.
Lieutenant Susie Sunshine was a Pollyanna-ish cartoon character in one of the Army papers, Freedom's Voice, who turned any misfortune into a cheerful quip.
I'll be back tomorrow.
I'm not going anywhere.
Valentine left.